Chapter 10. The Empty Forest. "Ah, good news," Gary said to me, looking up from the Bangkok Post at breakfast the morning after we returned to Thailand. "Really?" None of our reading material had provided much cheer of late. As Gary was reading the paper, I was going over a report we had picked up in Vientiane. "The sad fact is that all recent wildlife surveys indicate that wildlife throughout Lao PDR is declining," read the introduction. I was eager for some happy news. "Well," the professor said cheerfully, "it's a particularly torrential monsoon this year."
"Yes?"
"And it has hatched an unusually large crop of mosquitoes."
"Yes?"
"So now there's an epidemic of malaria."
"Are we at the good part yet?" I asked.
We were not. Gary and I were now in Chiang Mai, the 13th century capital of the former northern Thai kingdom of La Na, 150 kilometers from the border with northeast Burma. The newspaper story, which Gary read me aloud, adding his own commentary as he saw fit, concerned the warring tribes of the Hua and the Shan. Some 24 groups of ethnic rebels had been fighting the Burmese government along the border. The Hua and the Shan were among those tribes who were merely fighting each other. The Hua, or the Wild Hua, as they were once called, are well but not favorably known for their embarrassing custom of cutting other people's heads, we had learned from an account written in the 1950s, which they exhibit in the skull avenues of their strongly fortified hill villages. These days, however, the Hua were better known for manufacturing much of Asia's illegal amphetamines and heroin. To expand their operations, the tribe was eyeing territory now held by the Shan, whose creation myth claims they are the descendants of a great white tiger, who still sometimes walks the length of Shanland, followed by 50 ghost leopards. The Shan are not inhospitable people. One of the stories collected from them tells us small tremors are caused by subterranean dwarves, who, feeling lonely, knock on their ceiling. To this, the Shan respond by rushing from their homes, kneeling on the ground, and crying out to reassure them, "We are here!" But even the solicitous Shan did not appreciate the Hua's incursion into their territory and customer base, and were zealously preparing for war, one that, quote, "threatens to send thousands of refugees across the border into Thailand," the paper said. "I'm still waiting for the good news," I said.
"I'm getting to that," said the methodical professor. And he read on.
"Some 500 Hua militiamen have died of malaria in the last few months in the disputed district, and the heavy rain is hampering both groups' drug operations, the muddy roads forcing them to move amphetamines and heroin through the jungle on motorcycles." The happy news was that, because of flood and disease, the two tribes had agreed to postpone their turf battle, which meant, for us, that our progress was not likely to be impeded by warring, drug-selling headhunters. Once we met up with Gary Van Zylen that afternoon, we would be able to travel, as planned, the 200 kilometers southwest from Chiang Mai to Mae Sariang, 150 kilometers north to Mae Hong Song, and on to the Salween Wildlife Sanctuary, along the Burmese border. On the twisting mountainous drive to Mae Sariang in Gary Van Zylen's four-wheel drive Isuzu, the Australian told us about the Salween Sanctuary and his hopes for releasing captive bears there. We wondered, was the sanctuary on the edge of a war zone really the best place for this historic reintroduction? "Salween was badly hit by poachers," he answered. "You've got rebels, half a dozen ethnic minorities, Burmese troops up there, and they all come into the park. Thailand has more than 100 national parks, ranging from 3,000 square kilometers to less than 50. All but 4 of them have human settlements within their boundaries. Most of the people are refugees. 500,000 people, mostly known collectively as hill tribes, live in Thailand, but apart from the Thai. They originated farther to the north and northwest, from the mountains of South China, from northwest China, from Burma and Tibet. Like the moon bears whose lineages we were now tracing, they have been migrating south for centuries, displaced by invaders, by warfare, by political whim, by famine, and by drought. In Thailand's national parks and sanctuaries, they continue their traditional way of life as best they can, hunting, cutting wood,
planting opium. They're a nightmare for the parks people, Gary Van Zylen told us. They really tear up the place. And once it's ruined, they move on to deforest another area. But you can't move thousands of people. About 6 years before, some 10,000 Burmese refugees illegally settled in camps inside the Salween National Park. But the section he had in mind for the release was not in the park, but in the Salween Wildlife Sanctuary. Wildlife sanctuaries, of which there are 40 in Thailand, are set aside for conservation alone, not recreation, and they are under different and somewhat stricter administrative control. Visitors are not encouraged. The Salween Wildlife Sanctuary is relatively secure. Soldiers from Burma occasionally cross, the Australian said, but they just hang around. There's the odd shell. That, of course, wouldn't worry him. The only problem was they'd be unable to use airplanes to track the released bears with radio telemetry because the Burmese would take pot shots at us, he said. But that would be a minor inconvenience. Kerry Van Zylen had never seen the place. He would do so for the first time on this expedition. But even sight unseen, the Salween Sanctuary offered two shining advantages over most of the sites he has considered. One was that it had no hill tribes. The other was its director, his friend, Prichaw Ratanaporn. Prichaw is an absolutely all right guy, he told us, which meant he was a man of rare integrity. In the Forest Department, where an official could become rich from simply looking the other way at the right moment, Prichaw was scrupulously honest. Further, he had vision and was willing to try new things. With Prichaw, Gary Van Zylen did not face the problem of entropy that he'd grown to understand was endemic to third world government agencies. The official who does nothing, he told us, does nothing wrong. Any release of formerly captive bears carried a number of risks, risks few officials were willing to take. To minimize them, Gary Van Zylen planned to first acclimate the bears in a large fenced enclosure within the sanctuary. Before release to the wild, he planned to radio collar the bears to track them and make sure they didn't wander into villages outside the sanctuary. Initially, the ex-captives would be provisioned with food, which would gradually be phased out as the bears learned to find food in the wild for themselves. But would this ever happen? The scientist was optimistic. Even now, we are driving through what appeared to be magnificent forest. The beautiful Route 108 snakes upward into the mists of mountains covered with giant trees. This is not rainforest jungle, but a type known as mixed deciduous monsoon forest, dominated by teak, with its straight, strong, termite-resistant trunks and monstrous broad leaves, each as big around as the face of an ox. In the dry season, many of these trees' leaves would turn brown and drop. But now is the season of promise and plenty. The rains have brought the teak into bloom, with its huge clusters of light yellow puffballs, and many other trees are in fruit. The logans and durians and custard apples with their velvety cream flesh and watermelon-like seeds. This looks like perfectly gorgeous bear habitat, the scientist said to our host. There should be thousands or tens of thousands of moon bears in these forests alone. Gary Van Zylen looked shocked. There are no bears here, he said. Now it was the professor's turn to look shocked. He turned to me in the back seat. Can you imagine a forest this big in North America with no bears in it? Can you imagine that poaching has been that thorough? But Gary Van Zylen was adamant. There were plenty of bears once, but they sure as hell aren't anymore. They've all been hunted out by the hill tribes, their gallbladders sold in the market, or they've gone off in the back of someone's pickup to be sold to a restaurant 10 years ago. It seemed too awful to consider. Wasn't there somewhere, any park in Thailand where there was a chance we might see a bear, a wild bear living free? See a bear? Kerry Van Zylen parroted in astonishment, as if we just asked if we might bump into the Pope at a gas station. Nobody ever sees a bear. The Parks Department, who were looking for them for years, don't see a bear. The only ones who ever see a bear are poachers. Thailand's moon bears are refugees among refugees. There might be 150 bears in forest department breeding centers like Banglamong, perhaps some 40 in zoos, and maybe another 100 remaining in private hands. But in the wild? We spent a year looking for bears in this one sanctuary, he told us, where forest department workers had rigged up cameras to snap a picture of any animal who crossed in front of them. Not a single bear turned up. We talked with rangers who used to shoot them, he told us. Oh, yeah, they're bears, they'd say. Then you'd find out they were talking about when they saw one 9 years ago. No, I don't think there are many bears left. If you're going to look for a bear out there, you're going to have a goddamn hard time. We established our base at a dingy little hotel in the modest town of Mae Sarriang. The ambitiously named Samsri Resort featured Chinese-style showers, i.e. with no door or shower curtain. Turning one of its faucets merely dribbled cold water out of a hole in the wall, but the other sprayed fountains of hot water everywhere. It sprinkled the sink and the Western-style toilet, soaked the single ratty pink towel, melted the cardboard-like toilet paper, when there was any, and nourished a breathtaking floor-to-ceiling jungle of black mold. But the hotel staff was kind, serving us luscious fruits with our breakfast, and the place was convenient to Mr. Preachar's forest headquarters, less than half an hour's drive away. Unfortunately, Mr. Preachar was not in. He's expected back the day after tomorrow, we were told. So the next day, our host planned to take us to Amkoy Forest Conservation Center, where some dozen confiscated or donated moon bears were living out their lives in captivity, the luckiest of whom were in a big outdoor enclosure built by TSCWA. The Garys went on without me. Though my scientific companion's stomach problems had abated, mine had thickened into nausea, augmented by a raging sore throat. The men drove for hours in the Isuzu through gorgeous, bearless forest and returned elated. With the enormous pliers purchased in Long Prabang, the scientist, aided by facility staff, successfully plucked hairs from no fewer than 9 moon bears. For most of them, at least, the confiscation sites, if not the capture sites, were known. Station records indicated that 2 came from Mae Sarriang, from a border policeman who'd kept them as pets. One, partly blonde, may have been transferred from another forest department facility outside the town of Hot. 3 more bears were from Pra province, south of Nan, near the border with Lao, and near where Colonel Weirat said Bertha had come from, a report Gary was coming increasingly to doubt. If it were true, then haplotype 2 extended over an enormous range. But Gary Van Zylen considered it very unlikely that anyone would have brought a bear confiscated at the Laotian border to Lopburi, so far away. Gary Galbraith couldn't find Ban Pang Khe on any of his maps, and we wondered whether Colonel Weirat could have been mistaken, or if somehow what he'd meant to tell us had been lost in translation. The DNA in these hairs would help solve that mystery. We spent the day in the familiar Asian holding pattern, waiting. At our midday and evening meals at a Chinese restaurant down the street, Gary Van Zylen alternately amused and horrified us with tales of bureaucratic incompetence. So they raise the money for a satellite dish for the school, but guess what they don't have? Electricity. He told us of some of the red tape he faced working as a foreigner in a Thai charity. At one point, I had to sign a paper saying I wasn't authorized to sign documents. No wonder he was still awaiting approval from the upper echelons of the Forest Department to proceed with his reintroduction plans. Thailand's development has developed pear-shaped, he said, just developed enough to screw things up. We might end up doing a reintroduction in Laos and not in Thailand, because Laos won't have such a circus. How bizarre would that be? The professor and I spent most of the day continuing to comb through documents we'd obtained in Laos. Wildlife in Laos PDR 1999 status report was a litany of horrors. Army officers shot endangered gibbons for food. In Vientiane, people hunted birds on Buddhist temple grounds. Poachers took their booty past the front door of at least one prominent conservation organization unmolested. It seemed no species in Laos was exempt from human hunger, for food or for money. Under Asiatic black bear, we read that, historically, the species was common. but in their years of surveys, IUCN and Wildlife Conservation Society scientists had seen only skins and skulls. This is the only large carnivore with no recent wild sight records in Lao PDR. In other words, see a bear? You're going to have a goddamned hard time. But the depressing report also contained a short paragraph that made our hearts pound. In the Central Annamites, villagers often report two sorts of Asiatic black bear, which are said to differ in size and color of the chest pelage. This may explain the findings of Duckworth, where informants reported two sorts of bears, but stated differences between them were not the obvious morphological ones between Asiatic black bear and sun bear. We are hearing the same sorts of things over and over, the scientist said to me, electrified. The Hmong in Chicago say there are three kinds of bears, two of which are probably moon bears, and they are hunters. They should know. IUCN says their informants tell them there are two kinds of moon bears, one of which is bigger than the other. Further, he had heard something similar from a colleague in Vietnam with whom he had an irregular correspondence. The Vietnamese forester had written that hunters are always recording a third species of bear. A bear living on the border with Cambodia, he wrote, was considered distinctive not only for its appearance, but also for the qualities of its bile. Either there is something causing all these different people to mistake these things for two different kinds of moon bears, he said, or else there really are two species, and the haplotype information will be able to tell. The following day, we collected more samples. This time, we drove north to Mahang Song. Before the road from Chiang Mai was completed in 1965, the town was known as the Siberia of Thailand and considered a dumping ground for disgraced bureaucrats. Now, tour operators market it as Thailand's Shangri-La, and it receives more than 200,000 tourists a year. They come to trek in the beautiful mountain forest and gracious green valleys, and they come to view the colorful natives, people dressed in embroidered traditional costumes and elaborate headdresses, heaped with silver bells or decorated with coins or adorned with distinctive necklaces, earrings, and wrist bangles. But they are not natives. Mahang Song's population is only 2% Thai, in the sense of Siamese. 50% are Shan, originally inhabitants of Burma, or of the ancient kingdom of La Na in what is now northern Thailand, and the rest are hill tribes. Among the most popular tribes on the tourist agenda are the long-necked people, or giraffe women. They are members of the Padang tribe of Burma, a subset of the Karen people. What distinguishes the Padang is their women have for centuries worn tall coils of brass, sometimes weighing 12 pounds, around the neck, a custom that makes the neck appear nearly a foot long. Placed on the neck in childhood and lengthened as the girl grows, the ornament does not, in fact, stretch the neck, but pushes down the collarbones and ribcage, causing the shoulders to slope. The result is eerily graceful, a New York Times travel writer wrote, the head floating above the shoulders like the crown of a dandelion, the chin projected forward as if in perpetual curiosity. We saw their pictures posted prominently in many of the tour offices in town. Many of the Burmese Padang have abandoned the neck coils, which once served as a way to secure family wealth from theft. But today, among the refugees, the women themselves are the valued commodity. Tourists pay about $6 apiece to enter their villages. Some say these villages are little more than human zoos. But, meanwhile, some 20,000 Kareni refugees are living in poverty, crammed into a series of camps along the border or squatting illegally in national parks and sanctuaries. And while the human refugees spill into the wildlife parks, the native bears live at the zoo. All 8 moon bears at the Pang Tong Open Zoo, we were told, were local contributions. They'd been born wild in the forests nearby. From their cages, the bears could see the thick, handsome plantings of bamboo and flowering ginger on the zoo's well-tended grounds. They could smell the fruits ripening in the forests. Perhaps they could smell them from many miles away. Lynn Rogers tells how one American black bear he was watching responded to a wind change. He just turned his nose and loped directly toward the best hazelnut crop I'd ever seen. Guided by scent, the bear traveled all night and much of the next day, beelining to a lush hazelnut stand more than 40 miles away. To the bears, perhaps, such scents are like the fragrant blooms of the heavenly parachart trees, transporting them to recall former lives. If so, like human refugees, the zoo bears may have dreamed of returning to their homelands. Since all the bears were from the same area, it seemed unnecessary to bother all eight of them. We concentrated on getting hair from those who seemed friendliest. Three large female cubs, perhaps siblings, with markedly different crescents on their chests. As I snaked my tweezers through the wire aimed at one clambering cub, I noticed something big moving in their cage. It was one of the keepers, who just walked up to each of them one by one and pulled hair out with his hands. The scientist was pleased with the harvest. In 28 vials he carried constantly with him in his camera bag, he had now amassed samples from bears from much of northern Thailand and Laos. Our map was filling out. In town, our host took us for an elaborate Thai meal to celebrate. We careened back to the hotel in the dark. Dodging dogs, snakes, and other vehicles, we looped down the mountain roads through a forest both beautiful and bereft, emptied of bears and full instead of people who didn't want to be there but had no other place to go. The Salween River, born like the Mekong on the roof of the world in the frigid mountains of Tibet, its source is said to be protected by a naga sent by the gods of the sea. Earthquakes, say the Shan, are born of the wagging of the tail of a great fish who lives beneath its waters. It boils with rapids, swirls with sediment, and pours for 2,784 kilometers through a deep trough encased in steep mountain walls, running south to the Indian Ocean. The Salween is before us now. Across it, atop a wooden building with a metal roof, white letters on a red background spell out in English, Union of Myanmar. We stand beneath a leaf shelter at one of the gateways to the Salween National Park, watching the river swallow the rain. After multiple delays, it's taken us several hours to get here. Over zigzagging, torturous roads, we had traveled in two separate vehicles. Mr. Prechar, a stout, cheerful, confident man of 51, captained a Forest Department four-wheel drive truck, bristling with seven soldiers armed with M-16s. Gary Van Zylen's jeep followed, driven by the Salween substation chief, his belt holding a large combat knife, a revolver, and two extra clips for his rifle. The Australian held his M-16 between his legs in the front seat, while the scientist and I squashed into the back. We'd forded two rivers along the way, nearly miring in one. Now we were waiting for our boat. Mr. Prechar dispatched a soldier to find it. The Garys marvel at the forest across the river in Burma. This is not secondary forest, Gary Van Zylen says in surprise. He'd expected to find the Burmese side extensively logged, as logging has destroyed two-thirds of that country's original forests. I thought it would be like a sandbank, he exclaimed. It's basically virgin. The other Gary, though, is transfixed by the roiling river. He wonders aloud, do you think a bear could swim across that? Our long-tailed boat arrives, 40 feet long, low, open, wooden, a canoe, essentially. The long propeller sticks out the back, its long tail, attached to a 1.6-liter diesel car engine. For more than an hour, we travel the river, surrounded by a green wall of trees and vines and rain. We arrive at the sanctuary field station, sodden but exhilarated. We climb a muddy hill toward the station. The first thing we notice are the logs. Some 2,000 of them, each thrice the circumference of a telephone pole, lie in neat piles beside the boat landing. Mr. Prechar found them 2 years ago, shortly after he'd been given charge of the sanctuary. Illegal loggers had left them scattered all along the river to pick up later. He never found the poachers, he said. I just met the logs. he had to hire elephants to drag the logs nearly to the front steps of the forest substation building. If the poachers returned to reclaim their booty, his men would catch them. But they never came, and this spoke volumes. Mr. Preachar's soldiers were a powerful deterrent. Each log, he said, was worth 20,000 baht. $1 million worth of teak is lying there, and in 2 years no one has returned to touch it. We are amazed at the integrity of the forest we have seen. On both sides of the river, for our entire journey, we've been surrounded by a cascade of foliage, vines pouring out of giant trees, sensuous, luxuriant, like a woman's long hair trailing down a backless dress. It's very wild, the scientist says. There are no tracks on either side, and so few houses. Gary Van Zylen is eager to take us into the forest. He's hungry for our opinion. Could bears who had spent most of their lives in captivity remember how to survive in the wild? Could they do so here? Disappointingly, our explorations are confined to a muddy track surrounded by soldiers. Time only allows 2 hours for a walk. We don't glimpse a single mammal the entire time, not even a squirrel. We see very few birds. The scientist and I could not reasonably assess the forest for bear habitat, but we remembered something we had seen at Banglamong, and it gave us hope. 2 weeks before, we had witnessed an event for which Gary Van Zylen and his staff had spent weeks in preparation. A new 8,000-square-meter outdoor enclosure had been built for sun bears, rimmed with electric wire. Juliet, a subadult, was to be its first resident, and the guinea pig to see if the fence would hold bears. Gary might not admit to it, but Juliet is his favorite bear. With a brilliant orange setting sun on her velvet black chest, she's a beautiful, sweet animal who'd been hand-raised as a cub by owners who later gave her to police. She had sometimes frolicked outside under human supervision. But much of her life had been spent in a large cement-floored cage. It was handsomely appointed, with green-painted bars, climbing logs, and a shallow pool, but a cage nonetheless. On this day, we would see that change. Because sun bears can climb almost anything, the only fence that can keep them in is electric wire. But animals do not always react to electric wire the way we expect. If the initial shock of the electricity does not particularly impress them, they may decide to go through the fence anyway and never learn to fear it. Or the shock may simply enrage the animal, and instead of backing away, it will plow through. How will Juliet behave? This is a major milestone, Gary Van Zylen said to us, as the sleek little bear emerged confidently from her cage into the enclosure. After a few dozen paces, Juliet sat with her back to a mimosa tree. Then she approached the electric fence. She stood, touching it with both paws. We heard the crack of electricity. She cried out, an angry moan, just like a person, and raced behind the tree. "That's it! That's perfect! That's exactly what I want!" shouted Gary Van Zylen, genuinely overjoyed. But what happened next was the real breakthrough, one so subtle almost no one noticed. Juliet stood behind the tree, her two front paws steadying her as she peeked out from behind its protection, staring in wonderment at the invisible danger, trying to smell it, to hear it. She had received on her sensitive orange hands the maximum amount of shock, 13,000 volts. Because it was delivered in a pulse, it can't damage her physically. But it hurt, and she wanted to get farther away. She found another mimosa trunk and climbed it, lunging and gripping. She arrived at the crotch of the tree, about 15 feet up, and here she began to break branches with her hands, dropping some, but placing most of them beside and beneath her in the crotch of the tree. I gasped. "Do you realize what she's doing?" I asked Gary Van Zylen. He assumed she was simply destroying the tree, like the logs and tires she'd shredded with her long claws for amusement in her cage. But no. This is a well-known, complex, and completely natural behavior in arboreal bear species, including the American black bear. George Schaller described it in moon bears in his studies of the species in India and in China. Juliet was building what we in New England call a bear basket, a springy nest to cushion her weight as she rests and feeds. With her forepaws, she pulled a small branch toward her and then pushed it beneath her feet. A larger branch required a bite to break it. Holding each branch securely, she sniffed the ends of the twigs, sometimes nibbling at the leaves, then stuffed it beneath her, methodically building her platform. She had almost certainly never witnessed another bear doing this. She was captured as a very young cub. Mothers don't usually build bear baskets when their cubs are young. The fruits and nuts are not yet ripe, and most of the food is on the ground, not in the trees. And Juliet herself had never attempted to do this before. But now, offered a small measure of freedom, she has located the river of instinct that has been flowing inside her and allowed it to carry her away from her fear. Less than half an hour after her release, she has reconnected with her ursine heritage, joining her with her ancestors in bear knowing that stretched back beyond the Pleistocene, back beyond the Pliocene, to the ancient knowledge that runs deeper than learning, deeper than reasoning, deeper than thought. This is what gave us hope as we trudged down the muddy track in the empty forest. There were surely few, if any, bears left here, Mr. Preachar assured us. Thailand's laws had been passed too late to save them. On the rare occasion his men caught someone with a bear cub these days, it was coming to Thailand from Burma. The Salween Wildlife Sanctuary could be as bearless as the new lands those pioneering moon bears might have found in the early Pleistocene as they had migrated south from China. But emptiness bodes well for any new crop of colonists, as the scientists pointed out. The biggest danger to any bear who enters new territory is that another bear already owns it. For the ex-captive moon bears, the sanctuary could offer a clean slate, a new Eden. If Gary Van Zylen was able to secure permission from the Thai government to proceed with release, if Mr. Preachar could continue to keep poachers at bay, if the moon bear's natural instincts had not been extinguished by the years in captivity. Surrounded by forest, enveloped in rain, and flanked by hope and despair, our boat puttered back down the Salween along the troubled border.